You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
David Quammen has accompanied many of the world's top scientists and researchers from the jungles of the Congo to the woods of suburban New York as they study zoonosis, the transfer of disease from one species to another. Mr. Quammen traces the history and science of this in his latest book called Spillover, Animal Infections and the Next Human Pandemic. It's published by W.W. Norton. I'm very pleased that it has brought David Quammen back to our show. Hello.
Nice to be back with you, Leonard.
Haven't humans always been infected by animal-borne diseases like the bubonic plague?
Right. It's an old problem. It's an old situation. Bubonic plague, yellow fever, the influenzas, those are all zoonotic diseases. So it's been around. But there seems to be an increasing trend, an increasing drumbeat of these new scary emerging diseases in the last 40 or 50 years.
We're talking about AIDS, SARS, swine flu, bird flu. Is it because they're turning up more or just because modern communication makes us aware of them?
It's probably a combination of both. We're looking more carefully for these sorts of things. The science has become more sophisticated, so we're spotting them earlier. But it also seems to be objectively true that they are happening more and more frequently because of they're happening because of things that we do. And
now, the title of your book, Spillover, is that a lay term for zoonosis?
Well, spillover is the moment when one of these disease pathogens passes from one species to another, and in this context, passes from a non-human animal into the human population for the first time.
The bubonic plague killed an estimated 25 million people in the 14th century, which
had was a lot of people then.
even more impressive then. Can any emerging disease today present more of a threat than that?
Well, yes, because it can spread more widely across the world. I mean, the bubonic plague was devastating to Europe. I think they reckon it may have killed a third of Europe's population. And for Europeans, Europe was the world in the 14th century. Now our world is bigger and more interconnected.
So, well, it came from Asia across into Europe.
Right, yeah. But it came slowly. And the fact that travel was slower in those days would have, to some degree, mitigated the impact of a disease like that. The influenzas, presumably, have been emerging for thousands of years, too. They haven't spread across the planet because it's a disease that acts fairly quickly and travel was slow. Now travel is fast, so that even a disease that acts very quickly can spread to the opposite side of the planet in a matter of days or even 12 to 14 hours.
And you said that our actions with regard to the environment are responsible in part for this increase?
Certainly part of it, yeah. We are disrupting the wild ecosystems where biological diversity is great, and where biological diversity is great live a lot of viruses. You can reckon that every plant, animal, and fungus in the tropical forests probably has at least one unique virus of its own.
But haven't people always gone into those places?
We always have. Humans have been there, that's right, and diseases have been spilling over into humans, presumably for a very long time. But the scale of at which we're doing that is far greater now than ever before. And there are 7 billion of us humans around the planet. So when a disease does spill over and can transmit from human to human, it wins the sweepstakes potentially.
And in some cases, it almost seems like one person got it, and the next thing you know, you have millions of people affected by it.
Right. Some of these, as I say, move more quickly than others. AIDS has developed very slowly. It's slow to develop in one person, and it's relatively slow to transmit. So it has taken about a century for the AIDS pandemic to unfold. But some diseases move very, very quickly, as I said, the influenzas. And SARS, which came out of southern China in 2003, was in Toronto and Beijing and Singapore before people knew it.
In your previous books, like The Song of the Dodo and The Reluctant Mr. Darwin, you wrote extensively about the theory of evolution. You even edited an illustrated edition of The Origin of Species. Is there an evolutionary link to the spread of infectious diseases between animals and humans?
Absolutely. And this subject, this book, contains a lot of molecular biology. That's sort of outside my usual scientific beat. Usually I write about science of ecology and evolutionary biology. What I'm doing in this book is really writing about the ecology and evolutionary biology of scary viruses. And the ecology refers to the interaction between species that causes these things to spill over, interaction between monkeys and rodents and bats and humans. And evolution comes into play once a new virus is in a new host. So the AIDS virus, for instance, has been evolving in humans since the spillover.
Now, have diseases influenced human evolution in the past?
Presumably they have. It's hard for us to know. But
well, haven't they found fossilized viruses in the human genome?
Oh, they've found – that's right, yeah. They have found there's a type of virus called an endogenous retrovirus that essentially is a retrovirus. The HIV is a retrovirus, but these are viruses that have inserted themselves permanently into the human genome. So they are sort of an archaeological record of our ancient past exposure to viruses.
But you're also suggesting that humans affect the evolution of these diseases.
Absolutely. Viruses, like any other creature, are subject to Darwinian evolution. The fittest survive, and the fittest, in the case of an infectious pathogen like this, is the one that manages to get itself transmitted frequently enough, broadly enough. That doesn't necessarily mean it's going to be benign or not kill very many people. It may kill a large portion of the people that it infects, but if it gets transmitted onward before it kills a given person, then it can still be a very, very successful virus.
And don't they also evolve while they're infecting people?
They do. In particular, scientists worry about the RNA viruses, the single-stranded RNA viruses, as distinct from DNA viruses that carry their genome on the good old stable double helix. RNA viruses, when they reproduce themselves, make a lot of mistakes. They mutate a lot. And the more they mutate and the more abundantly they replicate, the more quickly they evolve.
A listener has written in to ask you to detail the differences between animals or insects that carry a disease as opposed to those who suffer from it. Mosquitoes, for instance, probably yeah. don't suffer from malaria.
Right. Mosquitoes, the term that the scientists use is vector. A vector is generally an arthropod, an insect, or a tick, or an invertebrate creature that carries a disease pathogen between hosts. The animals in which these viruses live before they spill over into us, the term for that is reservoir host. A virus lives in a reservoir host inconspicuously, relatively benignly, over long periods of time, replicating but not replicating very abundantly and not causing symptoms. And then it spills over into a new host. It might be carried by a vector to a new host, the way West Nile fever is carried to humans from birds, or it might spill directly into humans.
Although in some cases it may also be a destructive disease for the carrier.
Yes, but if...
Doesn't AIDS have an impact on HIV on primates in general?
It was thought for a long time that the simian precursor of HIV, which they call SIV, that it was benign in primates, in the monkeys and the apes, chimpanzees of Central Africa. And that was presumably because it had lived in them a very long time. We got the pandemic strain of HIV from chimpanzees, and now there's evidence that it might be pathogenic for chimpanzees too, possibly because it hasn't been in them very long. They may have gotten it in recent centuries or millennia from monkeys.
You write about the many different factors that have come together and have to come together in order for a disease to spill over from one species to another. Often it seems that it's just a matter of chance. Is it difficult in general for a virus to switch hosts?
In some cases it's difficult. For instance, we hear about hantavirus. People this summer were dying of hantavirus that they contracted in Yosemite because they stayed in cabins that were littered with mouse droppings. We know that hantavirus is carried in mice. It occasionally spills over into humans and causes horrible illness. And people think, well, it doesn't happen very often to humans, so it must be a rare virus. In fact, it's a very common virus in the deer mice in many parts of North America, but it doesn't spill over into humans very often.
And you say that despite our sense that Lyme disease comes from deer, it more often comes from mice and other rodents?
Well, deer, white-tailed deer are part of the cycle for Lyme disease. But the crucial part of the cycle in terms of human jeopardy of getting Lyme disease is at the lower end of the mammal scale, the small mammals, particularly white-footed mice, who are the animals that mainly infect the ticks that bite humans. By the time the tick gets on a deer in its adult phase, the mating time of its cycle, the chances are if it's going to bite a human, it has already bitten them. So people think if we've got a lot of white-tailed deer, there must be a lot of risk of Lyme disease. No. If you've got a lot of white-footed mice, there's a lot of risk of Lyme disease, and it only takes a few deer to support that.
David Quammen's latest book is Spillover, Animal Infections and the Next Human Pandemic. Your research led you to travel all around the world, especially to developing countries like China, Congo, Bangladesh. Is spillover more likely in those countries?
Well, it's more likely because those countries tend to have more biological diversity, particularly Congo. Central African forests are high in biological diversity.
These are equatorial areas in general also.
Right.
Is heat a factor?
Well, heat is a factor because the equatorial areas are the places that grow the greatest richness in biological diversity. And that's the main significance of the temperature scale. And Bangladesh and southern China, of course, are not very rich in biological diversity, but the populations are very dense. And in China in particular, there is a great vogue in southern China for eating wildlife. They call it the vogue of wild flavor. So people are eating, buying live wild animals. Some of them are being bred in captivity for restaurants, for cuisine, for gourmets of wild animals. It's not subsistence bushmeat, as you see in Central Africa, but that exposes people to these diseases.
And they must be aware of it. The Chinese government, the Vietnamese government must be aware.
They are, and since the SARS outbreak in 2003, some of those markets that specialize in wild animals for food have been suppressed, or at least they've been driven underground.
Now, your work has led you to meet people like Billy Koresh, you spent a week with him in the Congo. He's studying Ebola. Isn't that kind of dangerous?
It is. It is. You want to protect yourself. You want to be sensible.
How do you protect yourself against Ebola?
Well, rubber gloves, mask, apron, rubber boots. Ebola doesn't pass through the air, so it's not. It's a horrible, scary disease, but it's not as infectious as something like SARS or even the influenzas.
You spoke with Kelly Warfield, a researcher at Fort Detrick in Maryland, who in the course of her work was self-infected with Ebola virus. And she lived?
Well, there was a concern that she had a needle stick injury while she was doing research on Ebola. And because of that, she had to spend 21 days at Fort Detrick at the USAMRID, the Army Research Institute for Infectious Diseases, in what they call the slammer. So they isolated her for 21 days and took a lot of blood samples from her to see if she was going to get sick. And she did not. She was lucky.
Well, we haven't seen a major outbreak of Ebola. Is that because we have learned how to contain it, or are we just lucky?
Well, Ebola outbreaks every few years. For instance, this summer there have been two outbreaks in Central Africa. One is still going on in the Democratic Republic of the Congo. About 36 people have been killed. But it's not the one that we should fear as the next pandemic. It doesn't travel very well. It doesn't ride airplanes very well because it kills people so quickly, and usually it kills poor African villagers who are lucky if they can even get to a medical center in their provincial capital.
You went to Australia to interview Hume Field about the breakthrough on Hendra virus and ended up accompanying him. Bat catching?
Well, Hendra virus, yeah. Hendra virus is a very lethal virus that spills out of giant fruit bats in eastern and northern Australia and gets into horses and makes the horses terribly sick, kills a large portion of them, and then infects veterinarians and horse trainers and people who take care of those horses. So, and Hume Field is the person who discovered that this Hendra virus has its reservoir in fruit bats.
You spoke to a number of people who've been working with HIV/AIDS, and you mentioned earlier that it actually has been in humans a lot longer than we imagine. I think most people thought it somehow there was a crossover in the 70s. How have we traced it all the way back?
Through molecular phylogenetics, work done in just the last 5 years or so by a couple of wonderful scientists and their teams, Beatrice Hahn in Alabama, Michael Warby at the University of Arizona. their work using molecular phylogenetics on old tissue samples and samples from chimpanzees has told us that the pandemic spillover of AIDS, the strain that causes most of the AIDS cases around the world, spilled over from a single chimp into a single human in the southeastern corner of Cameroon as early as 1908, give or take a margin of error.
Wow. So one person and now, of course, millions.
One person, and then it simmered in Central Africa for decades, and finally it exploded.
Just one more thing before you go. The CDC announced yesterday that 15 people have died and another 230 have been infected with a strain of fungal meningitis in an outbreak that now has spanned 15 states. It was caused by a contaminated batch of steroid shots. Is there a spillover in this case?
It sounds like there isn't. I don't hear anybody talking about there being an animal reservoir. I don't know where that fungus came from. It's a horrible mistake that somebody made, but it's a little bit different kind of a case.
Well, how nervous should we be about zoonotic diseases? Are there any precautions that we can take?
There are precautions we can take as individuals and as citizens. If you're traveling in Central Africa, do not eat the monkeys. Do not eat dead chimps found on the forest floor. If you're living in Connecticut or New York, pick the ticks off your kid when he or she comes in from playing in the woods. If you're in Dallas, put a little insect repellent on so the mosquitoes don't bite you with West Nile. And support institutions like the CDC and the WHO that are taking care of the global monitoring and vigilance on this problem.
David Quammen's latest book is Spillover, Animal Infections and the Next Human Pandemic. It's published by Norton. Thank you so much for being with us.
You're very welcome, Leonard.